again by Clarence.
Oh, but wait. Last Sunday, Easter Sunday, Father Clarence awarded the gospel story from Matthew an Oscar for the best telling of the story of the resurrection. I, on the other hand, wish to give this gospel story from John 3 Olympic gold medals. I'm wearing one of them. John, our gospel writer, very specifically details this part of the Easter narrative, the accounts of Jesus' appearances with his disciples. He is the only gospel to include Thomas's part in the resurrection narrative. And so today, on the second Sunday, the second Sunday of Easter is when preacher after preacher after preacher will try and rescue poor Thomas because of the bad rap he gets for doubting. It's an edgy part of the story, and Thomas is being historically maligned for his role in it. And thankfully, today's mainline churches are no longer appalled that Thomas didn't climb on board immediately. But I can't help myself, and I will at some point circle back and do some of my own rescuing. But I must tell you, although Thomas has been such a familiar character, even to people who are not completely familiar with the greatest story ever told, it is not Thomas that jumps out at me when I read this gospel text for this morning, our appointed gospel for today. What catches my eye is the fact that the Jesus of Easter, the Jesus glorified in resurrection, the triumphal glowing Jesus of all of our Easter hymnody, our flowers, our candles, and our alleluias, Jesus still carries with him all of the nail punctures in his hands and a big open gash in his side, even after the resurrection. St. John really just, if he really wanted to make up an idle story, a great and a better story than Matthew, about Jesus walking out of the tomb unscathed, then wouldn't you think that he would have had the apostles saying something like, "Wow, Jesus, this is amazing. Not only are you risen from the dead, but you're completely healed. There's no evidence that you were crucified at all. So it's like Good Friday never even happened, right?" But nobody believes that, and nobody says that. Jesus offers them, when he comes into their presence, he offers them shalom, and he enters that locked room, but he offers them so much more than that. He holds up to them his own woundedness. And this is what makes Christianity so remarkable. The existential human condition is always part of God's life. God doesn't lift us out of our humanity. God desires to become part of our humanity. And Jesus is, without qualification, the consummation of that desire. Those wounds represent God's love and compassion for every one of us. Those wounds represent God's identification with and empathy for every one of us. Those wounds represent God's intense thirst for justice and for forgiveness and acceptance, and most of all, for mercy. Because those wounds are our wounds. And now let me go back and rescue Thomas Didymus, the twin. What do we know about Thomas? Well, we know that when Jesus was determined to go and visit the tomb of his friend, Lazarus, in Bethany, just 2 miles outside of Jerusalem, all of the disciples begged him not to go, all of them except one, Thomas. Do we also remember that he was the one who said, "Let us then go even to Jerusalem to die with him"? And there is a tradition alluded to enough times to make one think there's truth in it, which has Thomas traveling east to spread the gospel, to spread the good news, perhaps as far as India, where he was probably martyred. To this day, there are many old churches in Kerala and Goa, regions that are named after Thomas. Also, on the steppes of Mongolia, there is our second century stela in Aramaic script, speaking of the great apostle named Thomas, who was a follower of the way of Jesus. Maybe then, doubting Thomas is pretty inaccurate. Perhaps it should be dauntless Thomas. Now allow me just a little bit of creative license, as I feel that such a man wouldn't need the simple identifiers, the physical wounds and the gashes to prove Jesus' resurrection. Instead, I think Thomas also wanted to see the Jesus that he was willing to die for. He would believe it was Jesus if he could see the divine love and the compassion and the empathy and the justice and the forgiveness and the acceptance and above all, the mercy. He witnessed this sacrament named Jesus firsthand, and he wanted nothing more than to feel those qualities again, to know that they were again alive, to know that where there was still a gospel to preach. And Thomas found those qualities standing right before him in the resurrected Jesus. It was earlier in the Gospel of John that Jesus had told his apostles that they knew the way where he was going. And so it was Thomas, who said, "Hey, Lord, if we know where you're going, if we don't know where you're going, how can we know the way? If we don't know where you're going, how can we know how to get there?" Thomas was not afraid to look the fool in front of the class. In our baptismal rite, the priest prays over the newly formed Christian that the one being baptized be given an inquiring and discerning heart and the courage to will and to persevere. And that sounds like my Thomas. So no more doubting Thomas. I would say instead, inquiring and discerning Thomas, dauntless Thomas. How we over centuries have misbranded Thomas begs the question. How well has the Christian church dealt with doubt and inquiry and discernment? Is it a value from our baptismal covenant that we hold dear to our hearts? Or is it a nuisance for us to get around? Most all of the fights in church throughout the centuries have been about the black and white theology versus a theology of inquiry and discernment, and about finally settling on a truth versus allowing truth to be fluid and dynamic. Almost anyone who has left a church angrily has left because their version of black and white was being called into question. Anglicanism, the church I love, has always interwoven fluidity and dynamism into its very fabric. Anglicanism knows no black and white, save that God is love, period. And yet we so often seem like the other apostles who were afraid to ask the question, and we look sideways at the skeptic and those who are unsure about things, and unsure about the things that we say and that we do on Sundays. As one priest, my pastoral theology professor, puts it, faith is acquired and nurtured, deepened and strengthened, not by grasping security at the fragile straws of certainty, for they are too easily broken, nor by church leaders giving a lead by telling us what to believe and how to behave. Because if it's not the lead or the creed that people want to hear, they'll ignore it anyway. Rather, faith is an exploration and an adventure, not a fixed position, but a commitment to travel. Friends, it's in the uncertainties of the world, the sufferings, other people's and our own, be it a bad medical diagnosis, the loss of a beloved friend, Jim, sufferings in Palestinian townships or in Isfahan or Tumblr Ridge, that we all draw closest to the risen Christ. It is in his woundedness that we see our woundedness. And Dr. Taylor goes on, we too are confronted by the wounded hands and side of Jesus. And in the end, the strength of our faith, the depth of our belief, will not be measured by passive acceptance of doctrinal formulae or unthinking repetition of ancient creeds. Rather, it will be measured by our response, whether we walk away from the signs of suffering and sacrifice, from the challenge of living and dying for Christ, or whether, in the face of it all, we proclaim by our worship and our lives, my Lord and my God. I find this both daunting and discerning and maybe just a tiny bit doubting. Daunting because of the world, the very, very dangerous world we now live in. But I have to ask you, are you ready for the ride in this Easter season? Because there's no MapQuest or GPS to guide us. Because Jesus was wounded for the inquiring and the discerning hearts, the skeptics, and even the unbelievers. Because those wounds are our wounds. Jesus was truly Lord for Thomas, Lord for all the reasons that we should elevate Jesus and hold him as the very vision and mind of God in human form, in wounded form. To truly live this proclamation, we in turn need to reach out and touch the wounds of others and see in them my Lord and my God. Let me end with a little portion of the prayer in the words of Thomas Merton, who is my newest and favoritest prayer. Loving God, we have no idea where we are going. We do not see the road ahead of us. We cannot know for certain where it will end. But we believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. And we hope that the desire in all we do, and we hope that we will never do anything apart from that desire. And we know that if we do this, you will lead us by the right road. Therefore, we will trust you always, even when we feel lost and in the shadow of death. We will not fear, for you are ever with us. Amen.